news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all once again to the Micah Hanks program. Glad as always to be your host, and of course to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, looking ahead, and going in pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every week, right here in our analysis of all things happening in space-time. Hope you guys are doing great out there. Lots on my mind this week. Oh boy. Yeah, it was one of those interesting downloads this weekend. Tell you more about that here in just a moment. Of course, in the news this week, reports of bright green UFOs seen over Canada. And I've got a special report here on what the FAA has finally admitted regarding unidentified aerial phenomena. In fact, this isn't secondhand. This report is original reporting by yours truly via The Debrief. Some more on that in a moment as well. But later on, I mentioned over the weekend the big download. Yeah, I got a very concerned-sounding call from a fellow host of a radio program asking, have you seen this new Showtime series produced by J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot Company, UFO? That's right, that's the name, that's the title. Apparently nobody told J.J. Abrams that they call him UAP these days. Actually, I kid, I still like calling them UFOs too. And so apparently so does J.J. Abrams and the folks there at Bad Robot Entertainment. But yeah, this new Showtime series, I had not really been all that concerned about it or interested in trying to watch it. And then they made the first episode available for free. My brud, Kyle Filson, down there in the Great Lone Star State of Texas with the Expanded Perspectives podcast, actually sent me a link the other night. A lot of you guys actually were sending the link. And MJ Benias, our editor-in-chief over there with The Debrief, had also been telling McMillan and I about this during a call we were on. Said, have you guys watched this? It's surprising. Didn't go really in the direction I thought it would. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll watch it. But no, it was when Church called me over the weekend. Jimmy Church, that is. And he's saying, have you watched this? And he really hooked me because, I mean, admittedly, I'd gone ahead and reactivated my Showtime Go account. I had fully intended to watch it. But Jimmy calls and says, look, it's like he's going one direction and then there is a sharp turn and go right off the cliff, Thelma and Louise style. That's where this show goes. That's how Jimmy described it. And I said, okay, all right. You got me. I'll watch it. And so in addition to joining Jimmy on Fade to Black to discuss it, of course, I want to spend a little time talking about it on this episode. Now, we are going to be in the spoiler-free zone. We are going to somehow manage to have this conversation without giving away key details about this show, because naturally, if you haven't watched it yet, I don't want you to feel like you've missed out or like I've spoiled the entire thing. The way we will do this is I have curated a select number of topics, eras in ufological history that we are going to break down and analyze. We're going to look at key players, their roles, many of these being themes that are addressed in this Showtime series. And so I can provide this analysis, I think, skillfully, stealthily enough, in fact, such that you will be able to get the gist without me giving anything away. So, you have that to look forward to, whether or not you have watched this show, but if you happen to have seen all four episodes already, if anything, you may have a slightly deeper understanding about some of the points I'll be touching on as we get into the heart of the conversation. Before we get into all of that, of course, hope you guys are doing great out there and that your weekends, wherever you may be, whatever you were up to, were great. You know, it was also concerning over the weekend, especially on Sunday, as news began to make the rounds, images coming out of Afghanistan, I mean pure pandemonium over there. I saw brother John Greenwald posting about this on Twitter. Actually, you know, Stephen Greenstreet also, one of his tweets was arguably the most disturbing. It shows a transport aircraft taking off, and as the camera, or the smartphone, filming, this scene pans over what presumably is a person falling from the wing of this aircraft as it is flying off into the distance, can be seen. I mean, some of the imagery, especially from right there at the airport in Afghanistan, I mean, it was very, very sad. Earlier today, as of the day I am bringing you this dispatch, President Biden addressed the situation, emphatically holding his ground, defending his decision, saying this is not something that should have been passed off to another president. The buck stops here. And of course, he's going to get plenty of pushback from people. And I don't want to wade into politics. In fact, this week on Middle Theory, if you go over to middletheory.com, if you really want to hear what I have to say about all this stuff, I have a whole podcast this week I'll be dedicating to the Afghanistan situation, trying to look at it from a nonpartisan perspective and providing all points of view and perspectives on this issue. It's very nuanced, very difficult, but something I felt compelled to have to wade through in light of all this news. And so we won't get into that right now. But I will say this much. You know, for those who are criticizing and those who are looking at what's happening right now, I mean, if we go back to last fall, there was bipartisan support for the removal of troops from Afghanistan. No, I don't think anybody saw this coming, or if they did, they didn't see it happening this quickly. But again, to offer a very brief nonpartisan perspective here, there had been bipartisan support and polls showing a majority of Americans, not all of them, but a majority supported the idea of bringing our troops home. Now, in light of what's happening right now, it remains to be seen whether that was the right decision. History, one day, will look back, and as future history books are written, maybe we'll have a clearer picture. It's difficult to say how this is going to shake out right now. Of course, my heart goes out to anybody out there who's been affected, whether it is those in Afghanistan who are now very afraid for their future, those who are very worried about the encroachment of the Taliban and how quickly this happened, literally the majority of that occurring over the last couple of days, the utter chaos that has ensued. Naturally, my heart goes out to those who have been affected, and also, especially, in fact, to the families of U.S. servicemen and women who have fallen while serving in this decades-long conflict over there. 2 decades. In fact, later this year would have marked essentially 2 decades since we entered the war in Afghanistan. And so I have to ask, you know, how much longer can this go on? I realize right now people's feelings are really, really strong. Tensions are running high. So I don't want to dwell on that. But it would also be irresponsible of me as a broadcaster not to touch on that, considering that this is indeed the big news of the day. Maybe that will be the big news of the year, in fact. But again, we will wait and see. We will see what unfolds in the days ahead. Now is not the time to jump to conclusions, but certainly there is a lot of concern, given the kind of imagery we have seen coming out of Afghanistan in the last few days. Now, getting over into other news a little more pertinent to what we'll be discussing on the show this week. You know, it was brought to my attention in recent days that there was a sighting of a bright green object seen over Canada. Brandon Spector, reporting for Space.com, says late on July 30th, pilots of 2 separate aircraft, one military and one commercial, reported seeing a mysterious green UFO vanish into the clouds over the Gulf of St. Lawrence on the Atlantic coast of Canada. This initially reported, by the way, in World News by Vice, courtesy of reporter Daniel Otis, who has been covering the UFO situation up there in Canada now for quite a while. He actually reached out to me on Twitter in recent days, and he's going to join us here on the program in the days ahead to give us a full update on what's going on up there in Canada. But now, jumping over to his report from Vice, as he reports, according to an aviation incident report posted on the night of August 11th, both flights, aforementioned, reported seeing a bright green flying object that flew into a cloud, then disappeared in a stretch of open water between Quebec and Newfoundland. The KLM passenger flight, KLM 618, was traveling from Boston to Amsterdam while the Canadian military transport aircraft, CFC 4003, was flying between CFB Trenton, a base in Ontario, and Cologne, Germany. Few other details were made available in the report, which appeared in CADORS, the Canadian government's flight incident archive. In a previous story, Vice World News showed how this digital database contains dozens of UFO reports from airlines such as Air Canada, Porter, and WestJet. In a June investigation, Vice World News revealed how Canadian military personnel have been reporting UFOs for decades. Now, again, while there were few details provided about this object, a couple of things that are really interesting to me. A number of years ago in my book, The Ghost Rockets, I reported on an incident that occurred back in the 1990s involving multiple aircraft who were flying over Long Island Sound, and they saw something very similar. A sparkling green light flying on a horizontal trajectory higher than they were in altitude, and it remained in the sky for at least several seconds, maybe longer, but many of these aircraft saw this object. And there was later audio and then also a transcript released to the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter Davenport obtained that, which documented the details of this sighting. Now, most astronomers would hear this and say, "Guys, that's called a meteor." And in truth, I have seen green meteors. I have absolutely seen green fireballs in the sky. The coloration as they burn often has to do with the chemical composition of these space objects as they're burning their way through our atmosphere. But what was reported by the pilots in the 1990s incident was interesting to me because they said this object, to them, looked more like a missile than a meteor. And they noted that it appeared to remain in the sky, flying along horizontally, not streaking downward and quickly gone like a meteor. They said this thing, whatever it was in the air, it stayed in the air, and they watched it for several minutes as it passed on by. If we go all the way back to the early days of UFO studies here in the United States, I mean, starting in the late 1940s, we had these reports of so-called green fireballs. And indeed, some of the top experts in astronomy in the United States at that time, Dr. Lincoln LaPaz among them, people who were arguably some of the top experts on meteors at that time, you know, they too were observing these green fireballs, trying to get to the bottom of what they might represent, and they didn't think that these were natural celestial phenomena. So while it's easy to dismiss some of these accounts as simply being meteor sightings by inexperienced observers, maybe that isn't always the case. And so the recent sightings up there in Canada definitely sound a lot like the historical appearances of these so-called green fireballs. It's anybody's guess what those things actually are. Now, of course, what's also really interesting is the fact that when strange sightings occur, naturally, if you're in the United States airspace, you'd think that you'd contact who? Well, yeah, the Federal Aviation Administration, right? Since they are effectively tasked with overseeing all civil aviation issues in the United States and also over certain coastal water regions. But for a number of years, UFO researchers have noted the fact that indeed the FAA seems to have tried to have as little involvement as possible with the UFO situation. And in a recent article posted on August 13th over at thedebrief.org, I provided a full report on my investigations into this, and we'll have this linked in the show notes for you guys. I highly recommend heading over to thedebrief.org and check this out, because as we noted a few weeks ago in the complete breakdown I provided of the preliminary assessment by the UAP Task Force, it came as a surprise to many of us that they say the FAA has been collecting data for us, and they certainly have been providing a lot of information to us about things that pilots have seen. They have outreach programs to encourage pilots to report UAP sightings. I'm thinking, wait, this is news to me. Forbes also followed up reporting, well, this apparently is news to the FAA because they maintain that they don't collect data about UFO reports. The Daily Beast also followed up with this and were told the same thing. And so in light of this, I spent several weeks going back and forth with the FAA, trying to get clarification on this matter. And finally, after several weeks, I was given a statement by an FAA spokesperson. And this is essentially what they have told me. I quote, "The Federal Aviation Administration documents unidentified aerial phenomenon, UAP, sightings whenever a pilot reports one to an air traffic control facility." They also said, "If the pilot report can be corroborated with supporting information such as radar data, it is shared with the UAP task force." Now that essentially is all I was told, but it is, to my knowledge, One of the only times in recent memory that the FAA has gone on the record and said, yes, we do collect UFO reports, and here's why. This is probably, in my opinion, a recent development. No doubt, this is largely in support of the efforts of the UAP Task Force. I was given very few additional details, but again, this certainly marks a notable change in the FAA's policy, whether or not their own procedural orders and manuals actually state this policy. Because I went online, I checked, I double-checked, and we also, in the article there at the debrief, get into the history, because let me tell you, it gets a little strange. If you want to know all about how and why the FAA started passing off UFO reports to Robert Bigelow and Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies, well, we get into all of that and much more in the article. I'll have that linked in the show notes for you. And when we come back here in a moment, we're going to be shifting our attention over to the matter of, well, Showtime and its perspective on UFOs and some concerns I have. You're going to hear all about that here in a moment when we return on the Micah Hanks program. What are UFOs? Where are they from? And what does it all mean? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. These, of course, all questions asked in the new Showtime series produced by J.J. Abrams, UFO. Yeah, exactly. What is this all about? What are the UFOs? These aren't new questions, by the way. I'm sure you guys picked up on that. Yes, of course, these sorts of documentaries come out every few years, in fact, coinciding roughly with the appearance of this one on Showtime in recent days, was another program on Netflix, and I hadn't really rushed to try and watch either of these, admittedly. But as is often the case, people are saying, hey, Micah, we want your opinion on what's going on. Have you watched these shows? But what really kind of cemented it all for me, I mean, there had been so many people who were writing to me and saying, you know, this first episode of the Showtime series you can watch for free on YouTube. And I thought, okay, you know, whatever. It's free. I'll put it on. But during a call with Tim McMillan and MJ Banias the other day about some debrief stuff, MJ had basically said, have either of you guys watched this? Because this show actually, it goes in some rather surprising directions. And of course, after asking him kindly, please don't give us any spoilers, he then proceeded to give us synopses of all the episodes he'd watched. At that point, he hadn't watched the last installment in this four-part series, but gave us enough to pique our interest. And so I finally sat down, watched the first episode, not really covering a whole lot of new ground. Many of you out there having no doubt watched this first episode as well, and again, maybe I'll have that linked in the show notes for anyone who hasn't, so you can watch this on YouTube. But, you know, they lead off with the Phoenix Lights, among other things, and they're also interviewing people like Leslie Kane, John Greenwald of the Black Vault. He features on the program prominently throughout the series. But after that first episode, you know, my initial takeaway was, okay, this was extremely well produced. Again, what would you expect, you know, from J.J. Abrams? Now, granted, he has made some films over the years that I didn't care for. There was a tremendous amount of hype, if you guys remember, many moons ago, leading up to the release of the film Cloverfield. I mean, there had been this tremendous viral marketing campaign. It was absurd. I mean, there were phony websites put up. You know, there were all different kinds of hints and things that were being dropped in other programs that Abrams produced. And in this way, he could kind of tie all of these elements of his various programs together into a single universe. But the problem was, all of these elements that composed this viral marketing campaign for the Cloverfield film, they didn't actually go anywhere. A lot of them were almost entirely red herrings. And in fact, in large part, that has been part of JJ's style. Right? Just present a bunch of weird stuff that really gets people thinking, and then don't really take the story anywhere. Or if you do, take it in the last direction than the one that people thought that we were going. So before you sit down to watch a series like this, you know, it's important to keep in mind. Here we have a Hollywood filmmaker, you know, producer and director, and many of the projects that he has produced over the years get a lot of attention, but they don't necessarily coherently put everything together. Sometimes they do, but in many cases they do not. And especially with a lot of his earlier projects, like Cloverfield, this had kind of been the issue that I was seeing. Lots of hype, but then on delivery, does it live up to the hype that was generated? So after watching that first episode, UFO definitely starts off on the right note. And apparently a lot of people seem to think the same. The Daily Beast right here, Nick Shager reporting. I wish I could say that UFO definitively proves that aliens are among us, but at least Showtime's new four-part docuseries, produced by A.J. Abrams' Bad Robot, does contend that it's a possibility, given that we now have solid evidence of unidentified flying objects' existence. Now, of course, a lot of people would look at that opening statement there by Nick and say, well, lots to unpack. But we won't get into all of that right now. Let's just stick with the narrative. Using as its foundation the New York Times 2017 article, Glowing Auras and Black Money, the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program, this intriguing investigation into flying saucers and the possible extraterrestrials manning their controls is an attempt at legitimizing a field of study that's long been ridiculed by the public at large, as well as mythologized by the X-Files, Hollywood blockbusters, and the innumerable conspiracy theorists that populate the web. Now, the next line is probably key here. As Nick writes, on the basis of its first two episodes, which were all that was available at the time of this review, UFO is only partly successful in that endeavor. Of course, after the second episode, and mind you, I have seen all four, full disclosure, but there will be no spoilers here, so don't worry. But after watching all four, Nick might have spoken a little too soon there, because legitimizing the field of study that we call UFOs, I'm not sure that that is how people will necessarily feel after they have watched this program. And if anything, after gauging some of the reactions I've seen from people in recent days about this series, it's more of a Rorschach test than anything. Really, people all seem to come away with it with a different feeling. You know, the way that MJ described it, Jimmy Church called me on Saturday pretty worked up about it, and of course asked me to come on his show so that we could talk about it, among other things. But yeah, everybody seems to have a slightly different takeaway. Everyone who has watched it, who has spoken to me, their interpretation is a little different. With little doubt, that was intentional. But I will give you very briefly, without any spoilers, of course, I'll give you my general feeling. You know, I'll give a temperature reading here after having watched it. The show starts off kind of giving us an overview of significant UFO stuff of the last few decades, and then it really zeroes in episodes 3 and 4 on two subjects, the idea of government disinformation and alien abduction. And although the show presents nothing definitive, at times it certainly does seem to kind of be calling into question a lot of the predominant beliefs within the UFO community. And so I see why many in the community actually have taken issue with the tone of the documentary, especially in the last two episodes. But for my own part, I came away from watching it feeling a little more like what I had seen was in some ways both necessary to have said, but also it is perhaps not the deepest dive into this subject. And in sum total, even though I enjoyed the program, I thought it was incredibly well done, You know, it was a great production. The music, the imagery, I mean, the entire thing and the tone that it generates, it was really, really well done. But in terms of the topics that it covers and the way that it covers those topics, there are also moments where the predominant sense I got from watching this series was this is actually potentially doing more harm than good. Because although it is attempting to take a, at times, very skeptical look at UFOs, it is also presenting a rather paranoid perspective on what UFOs might represent. It's interesting how those who sometimes fall into the so-called skeptic camp are every bit as much conspiracy theorists in their interpretation, and that probably already comes close to giving away a lot of the tone, especially of Episode 3, so I'll stop right there. But again, with my concerns, as well as certain aspects of the series that I really enjoyed, all I can really tell people is, you know, you should watch it if you're interested in this topic. There are going to be things that you won't agree with. There are going to be some things that you may not have heard or seen before. But it's definitely entertaining. And at the end of the day, considering this being a production of J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot Company, and knowing what kinds of productions generally they are known for producing, you know, I went into it with those expectations, and I wasn't really disappointed after the fact. Right? I watched it. I don't think it was as severe as some people made it out to be. Maybe not as groundbreaking as others have made it out to be. Some people really liked this documentary series. I did like it. But here again, it's also covering a subject I'm very passionate about, and one which I strive to always walk that line, to find that balance on. The balance against bias. It's hard to do with any subject, especially one as contentious as UFOs. And I worry that some areas where this docuseries goes maybe potentially do more harm than good in terms of, you know, broadening our understanding, helping to destigmatize, and also presenting the case for the legitimate study of UFOs or UAP. So with all those considerations in mind, this week, rather than giving a blow-by-blow of the series, I thought it would be important to take a look at some of the topics that the show covers. And I'm going to do this in four parts, giving a background of 20th century elements that the show touches on, and a few others that aren't mentioned. And then doing the same thing with developments in the new millennium, mostly actually looking at developments that have not been covered in shows like this. That will bring us, of course, to 2017 with the New York Times article, you know, the arrival of the information about the ATIP program, TTSA, and the controversy that that group and its founding managed to generate. And then part four, we'll be looking at the MUFON component. This having to do with James Kurian, who is featured in the series, you know, his role as MUFON leadership at the time, why he left, what he began to believe after he left, and his interpretation of the historical context of UFOs, which I did find to be highly influential in this series. So we'll talk about all of these elements over the course of the program, but to kind of begin with an overview, I mean, if we were to really try to strip down UFOs in the 20th century, this series, of course, is all over the place, but essentially it goes no further back at any point than 1947, with Kenneth Arnold's sighting over Mount Rainier. And of course, this is where most UFO narratives begin. And I've taken issue with that in years past. That's one reason why it's so important, I think, to really look more deeply at the history. Because if your history begins in 1947 and you build your narrative around that, is it possible that there will be problems with the narrative you build based on a lack of seeing a bigger picture, if one exists? I argue yes, and in fact that there is a much bigger picture, that this phenomena seems to have been present much earlier, and we'll look at that a little later, but on account of that, that seems to present a lot of problems. It's easy to craft a narrative around UFOs appearing for the first time in 1947. And that narrative works for people who are not aware of the deeper history of this topic. So in UFO, the Showtime series, yeah, they don't go any further back than around 1947, with the exception of, I think in episode 4 they make passing reference. George Knapp, who also is featured in various parts of this series, is talking about pre-1947 encounters, and they flash a bunch of scenes of obvious religious imagery, which have been popularly associated with possible sightings of UFOs since antiquity. So they do make mention of that. But really what we're looking at in this series, and if we're to try and provide a brief overview of 20th century ufology, while I would argue that this phenomena extends much further back than just 1947, what we absolutely can recognize with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947 and also with the Roswell incident that occurred that same summer and other sightings, military and civilian, that were occurring around that time. What we absolutely, in fact, cannot deny is the arrival in the cultural consciousness of the idea of the flying saucer. And they would continue to be called that, essentially, up until around 1952, when the term UFO is first introduced. But even prior to that, and this is kind of interesting, documents that were produced by the U.S. Air Force and its attempts at trying to analyze this problem, prior to calling them UFOs, mind you, it did refer to various types of aerial phenomena. So a lot of different names were given to the phenomenon just in the first few years. And of course, we have Project Sign. Project Sign is mostly hopeful, and this produces this estimate of the situation, which of course we've talked about plenty in the past. No need to revisit that right now. All that we really need to know for this brief overview is that top brass in Washington did not like how open this so-called estimate of the situation under Project Sign had been to the possibility of the extraterrestrial hypothesis in support of these flying saucers that were being seen, many of them not even remotely saucer-shaped or behaving in any way like the flying discs described by Kenneth Arnold. And so the estimate of the situation was lost to history because all copies were ordered burned and destroyed. Project Grudge, which is the successor to Project Sign, takes a much more hard-nosed, skeptical kind of attitude toward UFOs, and essentially pre-concludes nothing to see here. In fact, that's the kind of narrative we want to present, so we're going to make sure that's the conclusion that we find. But it wasn't as easy as that. UFOs didn't go away. And by 1952, with the establishment of Project Blue Book, the Air Force was essentially welcoming reports of the sightings of the so-called flying saucers. Whatever these things are, we are interested enough, we are looking into it, we want reports. And reports they did receive. And this essentially continues throughout the 1950s, but the major takeaway here is that in those early years, from the late 40s and through the 50s, UFOs are essentially seen, during this era, as a military issue. This is a problem for our military, because right after the Second World War, if somebody has a technology and we don't know whose it is, that presents a national security problem. Now, of course, there are those, and again, I mentioned James Carrion earlier, he being one of them, but there are those who would say, really, we couldn't imagine a better ruse. If we wanted to try and fool enemies of the United States into thinking that we had capabilities that they did not, all one would need to do is start planting stories of sightings of advanced technology. Act like we don't know what it is. And what, of course, our enemies will conclude is, well, they are reporting this. They say they don't know what it is, but we know it ain't ours. And these things are being seen over the Americas, so who's got the super weapons, right? More on that to follow. But in sum total, yeah, the 1940s and 50s era of UFOs, the golden age of flying saucers, as it were, it was primarily an issue for the military during those years. And that would remain true on into the 1960s because, of course, with the continuation of Project Blue Book, which endured almost through that entire decade, yes, the U.S. Air Force maintained a role in all of this and continued to collect reports. Meanwhile, the nature of the phenomenon, of course, expanded more in the public consciousness. UFO books were beginning to proliferate. During the 1950s, a lot of those early books on flying saucers had been written by, you know, tabloid reporters like Frank Scully and people like this, and they did present a essentially very sensationalized viewpoint on the whole flying saucer mystery. A lot of the early tropes about crashed flying saucers and wreckage retrievals and things appeared in works like those of Frank Scholes' Behind the Flying Saucers. But with the 1960s, we see a bit of a different tone. Because during this era, we are seeing the publication of books by Dr. Donald Menzel of Harvard, again, a Harvard astronomer, whose attitude towards subjects like this was, let's just say, very different from Avi Loeb. Yeah, Menzel was the arch skeptic of his day, and he was also a rather prolific author when it came to UFOs. He wrote a lot about that. We also had in the 1960s the publication of Anatomy of a Phenomenon by Jacques Vallée. Jacques Vallée had only recently obtained his own PhD here stateside, and he became one of the first scientists to really write a scientific perspective on the UFO issue that was pro-UFO. And he even later noted that in his private journals published under the title Forbidden Science, Volumes 1 through 4, he noted, you know, Menzel is really the big guy in this field right now. I'm small potatoes. But nonetheless, it was a notable early contribution with Anatomy of a Phenomenon from Dr. Vallée, being one of the few scientists first to kind of jump in there and say, okay, here is a scientific perspective that is pro-UFO. Not to mention, of course, that by that time, the advisor to Project Blue Book, J. Allen Hynek, he also was becoming much more open to the idea that, okay, maybe there is a there. After being initially fairly skeptical, his tone begins to shift a bit. But, of course, he wasn't yet writing books about that because he was trying to maintain a degree of objectivity while still working in this official capacity with the Air Force. Nonetheless, Vallée and Hynek both really becoming proponents of the serious study of UFOs. They were initially very hopeful when it was finally announced by the late 1960s that the Air Force would be awarding a contract to the University of Colorado, and Edward U. Condon, a physicist, would be carrying out a serious, systematic study of UFO data. Initially, they were very hopeful. They thought this would be good for science. But of course, things didn't quite end up turning out that way. And so when we come back, we will look at the outcome of the Condon Committee and its report, the 73 wave, and the earliest claims of abduction when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. UFOs are on my mind. But then again, what else is new, right? UFOs are always on my mind. Being the timely subject that they are, and of course we are now, in addition to looking at the history of this topic and what it all means to us today, we're also analyzing this new series on Showtime, which does look at a bit of the history of this topic in its own unique way. Again, arguably one of the better series I've actually watched on this subject in recent years, but it's also, in a lot of ways, got a more controversial tone than most. And for me, really, one of the big takeaways from watching this is, my gosh, paranoia runs supreme with this subject. There's no way you can talk about it without that paranoia seeping in at some point. And I would argue that any one among us, you know, from the historians to the serious scientists, you know, astronomers we've had on the show, everyone on some level recognizes that paranoia. I mean, again, you look at Avi Loeb saying the skies aren't classified, scientists should get out there and start looking for these things. Again, the insinuation being that, well, we can't rely on government to give us what they've got. But of course, the reality, I mean, the long-held reality of government agencies watching civilian UFO groups, that may not be something that's discussed as much in the current dialogue, but if you go back and you read books like, you know, Jim and Coral Lorenzen, who ran the APRO Civilian UFO Investigative Group, they were talking about what level of involvement does the CIA have? Are there people watching, even infiltrating UFO groups? I got news for you. Yeah, they were right. The CIA for years said they had no involvement. Not true. That didn't come out until many decades later, but the Lorenzens were spot on. And we did an episode a while back about the APRO investigations and their claims that the CIA had been much more involved far earlier. They even suspected that members of said intelligence agency had infiltrated their organization. And I don't doubt that was probably true. But that's a story for another time. Where we left off, we've been talking about how Hynek and Vallée had initially been extremely hopeful when it was announced that the Air Force had awarded a contract. You know, Vallée in his private notes had said, you know, this may eventually lead to the establishment of an investigative committee by scientists. Maybe Alan and I will be on that. I don't think anybody saw it going the way that it did. The Condon Committee releases its report. Nothing to see here. Science isn't benefiting. Blue Book closes down. And the New York Times closes shop on its UFO reporting for a number of years. But that changed somewhat in 1973. When there were an incredible number of sightings that occurred that year. 1973 was also notable because one of the more high-profile claims of alien abduction occurs that year. Because in 1973, two Pascagoula, Mississippi residents, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker, are out there fishing off the dock near their place of employment, and they suddenly see this blue, egg-shaped object come sweeping down over the river, and the thing comes really close, takes them on board, and takes them for the ride of their lives. Now, there's actually no evidence that they went anywhere. They were essentially just taken on board and examined, but it really shook up both of these guys after this happened. It would be just a few years later in the late 1970s when Travis Walton also claimed that he had been taken aboard a UFO. He actually had been transported from the location where this incident occurred. And of course, the story is pretty well known. Again, we won't get into all the details here. If you want to hear his entire story, just go online. Of course, he was on Joe Rogan a few months ago telling his story, so you can hear the entire thing there. But Travis Walton, of course, has maintained throughout his life that essentially what he said happened back in the late 1970s is exactly how it happened. He has never really changed his story much. And it was throughout the 1970s with the publication of a book and also a made-for-television film that another, earlier, abduction was more widely publicized. That, of course, was the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill, which actually occurred in 1961. One of the commentators that appears on camera in the Showtime series said it happened in the 1950s. I don't know where she got that. The events in question occurred in 1961, but it wasn't really reported until much later, although the Hills had gone to UFO meetings and had privately talked about their experience for years. But then when John G. Fuller writes his book, The Interrupted Journey, that's what really brings a lot of attention to this. And it is still essentially considered one of those benchmark cases in UFO history. You know, some of our listeners have written to me in the past and said, why don't you do a whole episode about the Betty and Barney Hill case? Really, the only reason I have not done more extensive reporting on that case is because there's already so much that has been said. And of course, in the past, when I have talked about it, I mean, I do have a few problems with the story myself. I mean, there are a number of issues. Certain aspects of the story did change over time. Initially, the Hills came back from the experience with no real recollection. Betty kept having these dreams, though. Initially, Barney didn't want to hear anything about it. Betty's dreams, of course, conveyed little guys in flight suits with hats and big noses who spoke with German accents, or something to that effect. Very interesting description, by the way. And they had actually talked about Betty's dream remembrances at UFO events that they'd attended. Betty had talked to her sister I think her sister, just weeks before the actual trip where the incident occurred, I think Betty's own sister had said she thought she'd seen a UFO. And so some skeptics have said, well, it was obviously on Betty's mind, right? The whole UFO thing. And then they eventually go to Benjamin Simon, and they undergo, you guessed it, hypnosis. And so the full recollection of events that transpired doesn't come out until after hypnosis has been induced. And to me, this is just my opinion, but that is a problem because, of course, we know how easily suggestible people can become under the influence of hypnosis. If we look back at the Satanic Panic, I mean, people had been put in jail based on nothing but the testimony of people who had been placed under hypnosis and claimed to have remembered, you know, horrific experiments and abuse that they'd suffered, which later in some instances, upon physical examination by doctors, was proven to have been impossible, could not have happened. And yet people had actually been sentenced to prison based on faulty testimony from hypnosis-induced recollections, where even those who had given the recollections had to accept, you know, I obviously had not experienced those things. This had been something that was a result of the hypnosis and the suggestive nature of that experience. Now, does that mean that all claims of alien abduction are untrue? I'm certainly not saying that. I couldn't really tell you. But, again, with the Betty and Barney Hill case, while I find it to be a really interesting story, again, I'm merely admitting that there are some problems with it. Now, a lot of skeptics see those problems and they say there are enough problems that we could just completely dismiss it. I'm not to that point. I still recognize it as, again, one of these events in UFO history of great significance. But, really, what else can be said about it? It's no smoking gun, no more than Roswell or any other UFO case. And that seems to be one of the problems with the UFO situation en masse, is how ephemeral it is. For it to really be a serious phenomena and one worthy of study, you'd think that there would be more in all the decades we've been studying it that would have risen to the surface that is indeed representative of a physical reality of it. And of course, I do believe that there is a physical reality. I do think that there's enough evidence to support that conclusion. But there is still surprisingly little evidence, considering how long we have been putting attention toward this. I hope you follow me. But in light of the stories of Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker, and others, by the 80s and 90s, of course, what are we seeing? Really, the abduction stories are now leading the UFO narrative, and this primarily as a result of the publication of two books, Bud Hopkins' Intruders and Whitley Strieber's book, Communion. But also, of course, there was a lot of prestige brought to the idea of abductions by Harvard psychologist John Mack, whose work figures heavily into the fourth episode of the Showtime series. And so all these factors are going on, and they are really helping to, if nothing else, keep UFOs on the public mind. But with the arrival of the 1990s, of course, we have the claims of Bob Lazar, and we have one of the largest, most high-profile mass sightings of a purported UFO in all of history. And that, of course, is the Phoenix Lights incident, where many Phoenix residents said that they saw a large, triangular-shaped object flying over Phoenix, Arizona. Fife Symington, the governor at the time, also claimed that he observed this thing, and yet he went out there during a press conference and made folly of it, and never was able to really, fully live that down. In fact, in this first episode of the Showtime series, you can watch this for free on YouTube right now, remember, but there's Fife Symington still talking about his experience seeing this thing and then making fun of UFO witnesses that kind of paint him as the bad guy. Whether or not he really is, I don't think that what he did and how he reacted to that situation at the time necessarily helped. We're going to bring this conversation into the new millennium when we return, right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Exploring the history, the cultural significance, and of course, the lingering questions, the paranoia that surrounds the ever-enduring topic of UFOs this week. Of course, a lot of buzz about this new Showtime series. But is the presentation on the subject that it gives necessarily the most accurate one? Again, I have a few concerns. More on that a bit later. And of course, if you enjoy this podcast and you listen every week and you'd like to get a little bit more of the program, a little more dialogue and discussion, head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see X memberships. Click that. You can become a subscriber. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. It's a great way to support the hard work that goes into all of the commentary and content that we produce. And of course, you get additional weekly shows and monthly specials. We'll be dropping a new episode of Enigmas here in just days. A lot to look out for, a lot more to look forward to once you become a subscriber. And of course, you can always spread the good word, share with your friends and family, coworkers, whomever you so choose. If you enjoy this program, you may pass along a recommendation. Let them know that they too would enjoy it. And of course, if you head over to MicahHanks.com/shows, you'll find all the podcasts I produce. In fact, it's real simple. I've actually updated the main page there at MicahHanks.com. So really, pretty much everything I do, if you want to know about me or if you want to find one of my podcasts, you can find them right there. So just head over to MicahHanks.com. Easy, and it's fun. And of course, don't forget about the weekly intelligence brief newsletter that I send out from thedebrief.org. I handle the newsletter, but of course, there's original reporting going out every day via our cadre of writers and contributors there at The Debrief. Hard work that we put into that. And of course, we're sure that you guys will enjoy it. Now, picking up the dialogue here, we made our way rather quickly through the 20th century. Far less time to have to cover looking at the new millennium, and yet there's so much to say. It's interesting if you go back and you look at UFO news stories from around the turn of the last century and see how much the tone has shifted. For instance, we had the Washington Post way back in 2001, and I'll quote from this WashPro piece. A group of people, it says, who believe in UFOs held a news conference yesterday morning that established beyond the shadow of a doubt that reached levels of credibility so high as to constitute actual proof that there really do exist people who believe in UFOs. That's right, they say this was the big day for the Disclosure Project, an attempt to incite the government to admit that unidentified flying objects are piloted by creatures from another world. The organizer, Stephen Greer, a Charlottesville emergency room physician, announced that this was a moment of historic, indeed planetary, significance. This is the end of the childhood of the human race, Greer had said at the time. It is time for us to become mature adults among the cosmic civilizations that are out there. As the WashPro reported at the time, Greer had arranged an impressive venue, the main ballroom of the National Press Club. Upward of 100 people were there, along with more than a dozen TV cameras. At a long table up front sat 20 witnesses, most of them gray-haired men who had served in the military. If all this sounds familiar, it's because it is. The National Press Club actually has quite a history of involvement with events aimed at trying to bring broader attention to the UFO issue. We also had ABC News reporting at the time. May 10th, 2001, they're out there and the government knows. That's according to a group of about 20 former government workers, many of them military and security officials, who stepped forward on Wednesday to say they had witnessed evidence of aliens and unidentified flying objects and called for congressional hearings about such sightings. If this sounds familiar, that's certainly because it is. Yes, here again in recent days, more hopeful proponents and even lawmakers saying, yeah, we're hoping to get congressional hearings. Well, people have been trying to do that for years. But if it seemed that there was momentum building behind the case for disclosure back in 2001, a mere 5 years later, that tone had shifted somewhat. We had an article by Ben McIntyre that appeared Friday, March 3rd, 2006, in the UK's Sunday Times. The piece titled, ET's Flown Home, Chased Off by the Internet. He said the disappearance of flying saucers and little green men and a shift in human credulity. As McIntyre wrote in 2006, where on earth have all the unidentified flying objects gone? Just a few years ago, the sky seemed to be littered with flying saucers and every other sort of astral crockery. Strange lights, cigar-shaped spaceships, paranormal things that went bump in the night. Scully and Mulder were rushed off their feet. He says, now the UFOs have almost vanished. Sure, you still get a few alien abductions, especially on New Year's Eve, and die-hard ufologists are still recording close encounters of the upteenth kind. Since 1955, he says, the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle has clocked 125,000 reports of sightings, but in recent years the numbers have dropped dramatically. He goes on, but I think you get the gist of what he's trying to say. By 2006, flying saucers were no more. All the wisdom afforded us on the internet seems to have helped drive the death nails into the coffin. In other words, we're finally getting over this silly modern myth that are UFOs. Little did Mr. McIntyre know in 2006 when he was writing this that a mere 2 years, less than that, actually, beforehand, a U.S. Navy fleet operating off the coast of California had been watching unusual phenomena for days, culminating in an intercept attempt with a so-called Tic Tac, a story that wouldn't come to light still for a number of years. But not to be dissuaded by such naysaying, in 2010, Robert Hastings, another unique figure in all of this, his main thrust had been, UFOs show up around nuclear sites. There is abundant evidence of this. There are people who have witnessed it. It's time that we bring them into the spotlight and their stories be heard. And indeed, that's exactly what happened in 2010 when, much like those who had come before him, Robert Hastings held an event at the National Press Club. According to a CBS News article at the time, UFO researcher Robert Hastings of Albuquerque, New Mexico, who organized the National Press Club briefing, said more than 120 former service members had told him they'd seen unidentified flying objects near nuclear weapons storage and testing grounds. Stars and Stripes quoted former Air Force Captain Robert Salas, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana in 1967, when 10 ICMs he was overseeing suddenly became inoperative. At the same time, base security informed him of a mysterious, red glowing object in the sky. Robert Jameson, a retired USAF nuclear missile targeting officer, told of several occasions having to go out and restart missiles that had been deactivated after UFOs were sighted nearby. Similar sightings at nuclear sites in the former Soviet Union and in Britain were also related. And so that was all going down back in 2010. There was also an official news release that appeared some weeks later, following the event. The UFOs and Nukes Connection press conference held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., a press release read, on September 27, 2010, and streamed live by CNN, has generated extensive and ongoing media interest worldwide. The original press release was distributed by PR Newswire. The lead was, U.S. nuclear weapons have been compromised by unidentified aerial objects, followed by ex-military men say unknown intruders have monitored and even tampered with American nuclear missiles, and group to call on U.S. government to reveal facts. Now, coming back to McIntyre's op-ed there in the Sunday Times from 2006, I mean, for a phenomenon that seems to have been dealt the death blow by the internet and revealed as a modern myth, an awful lot of former military officials had been coming forward in 2010 and saying, nah, we've seen these things, we know something is out there. But what exactly? What exactly are these mysteries of the skies? 3 years later, we also had another event held there at the press club, this one known as the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure. As it was described by Josh Zitza, writing for the Daily Beast, he said, after truthers and false flags, an old-school conspiracy theory with benign little green men, flying saucers, and midnight visits by mysterious government agents is almost refreshing. Though you wouldn't know it from the weary faces of the former members of Congress listening to testimony this week. How this all shook out was that in 2013 there was this event held up there, billed as the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure. Five former representatives and former senators, or at least one senator, had been paid basically to sit there and listen to testimony presented all week by the UFO community in support of the reality of UFOs. As Josh wrote for the Daily Beast, the faux hearing is the latest attempt by the Paradigm Research Group to bring attention to extraterrestrials. Its last was in 2011, when the White House responded to its petition by denying any extraterrestrial contact and politely referring them to real searches for alien life like SETI. Paradigm plans to use footage from the panel, lent a bit of apparent authority by the former members of Congress, to make a movie about the alleged government cover-up of alien life. Now, of course, one can debate all day the merit of a faux hearing with former members of government sitting there and listening to members of the UFO community present the case for the reality of UFOs for a week, and then a film being made about it. But I think that the really important takeaway is that whatever varying degrees of success these events that we've described here had seen in the early 2000s, the big takeaway to me had been that after the turn of the last century, coming out of the 80s and the 90s, where there had always been insinuations about government involvement, I mean, that going all the way back to the 40s, that's nothing new. But with all of the emphasis that had been placed on abductions and on Area 51 and purported crash wreckage retrievals, the U.S. Air Force reopening its Roswell investigation, you know, coming out of the 1990s into the new millennium and now seeing concerted effort by various groups to try and bring attention to the subject and to elicit a response, a proactive response from government. That is really, to me, what the defining tone of UFOs in the new millennium has been. It has been a shift away from the folklore and the collection of sighting reports and an emphasis on government officials need to look at this because former and present members of government have experienced it. Here are their stories. What are we going to do about it? Although Joseph P. Laycock, assistant professor of religious studies at Texas State University, by 2016 was still asking, really, why are people starting to believe in UFOs again? In fact, that was the title of an op-ed he wrote for The Conversation, which we'll have linked in the show notes as always. But he made a number of the same sorts of observations that we're making here. He said the 1990s were a high watermark for public interest in UFOs and alien abduction. Shows like The X-Files and Fox's Alien Autopsy Hoax were primetime events, while MIT even hosted an academic conference on the abduction phenomenon. But in the first decade of the 21st century, interest in UFOs began to wane. Fewer sightings were reported, and established amateur research groups like the British Flying Saucer Bureau disbanded. In 2006, and he mentions again the op-ed by Ben McIntyre, he says essentially that McIntyre suggested that UFOs had been chased off by the internet. Data, Laycock writes, seems to back up McIntyre's argument. When it came to belief in UFOs, reason was winning out. A 1990 Gallup poll found that 27% of Americans believed extraterrestrial beings had visited Earth at some time in the past. That number rose to 33% in 2001 before dropping back to 24% in 2005. But now, Laycock wrote in 2016, the X-Files is back, and Hillary Clinton has even pledged to disclose what the government knows about aliens if elected president. Meanwhile, a recent Boston Globe article by Linda Rodriguez McRobbie suggests that belief in UFOs may be growing. She points to a 2015 Ipsos poll, which reported that 45% of Americans believe extraterrestrials have visited Earth. So much for reason, Laycock bemoaned, asking, why does Western society continue to be fascinated with the paranormal? If science doesn't automatically kill belief in UFOs, why do reports of UFOs and alien abductions go in and out of fashion? Of course, he noted in 2016 when he wrote this that it is to some extent political, but by the following year, once 2017 rolled around, that would become more evident than ever. In fact, the entire nature of the UFO debate would significantly change in 2017. And when we come back, of course, we will analyze that and much more here on the Micah Hanks Program. October 11th, 2017, top leadership talent from U.S. Department of Defense, aerospace, and entertainment industries join forces to bring transformative science out of the shadows. That's right, this part of the verbiage included on a press release announcing the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. And yet, as controversial as this would end up being, this wasn't really what we might call the shot heard around the world. Not yet. Welcome back. Now, of course, as we were discussing in the last segment, leading up to around 2016, I mean, there had been those who were already trying to say UFOs and belief in them, belief in little green men, that's a thing of the last decade. Despite, of course, consistent efforts by civilian UFO groups to try and bring not only awareness to the issue, but also to emphasize the role government seems to have played in it. But as we now know, 2017 would be the year that much of that tone began to shift. And although as early as October of that year, we already knew that there were former defense officials who were teaming up with former Blink-182 rocker Tom DeLonge in a new, you know, really, what would you call it? I think that they called themselves a entertainment company, but they were also supposed to be doing science. Yeah, as early as October of that year, we had the following press release. Today marks the official launch, October 11th, 2017, of the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, a consortium of scientists, aerospace engineers, and creatives that will work collectively to allow gifted researchers the freedom to explore exotic science and technologies with the infrastructure and resources to rapidly transition innovative ideas into world-changing products and services. Now, if that sounds like word salad, it sort of is. Again, throughout the duration of To the Stars, and they are still a thing, although some of the main members and most controversial key players have since left the organization as of January of this year. But at the time of the announcement of its founding, it was basically announced that this would be a science, aerospace, and entertainment company with all these different divisions. As far as who actually was a part of this organization, we had Tom DeLonge, president and CEO. We also had James Semivan, vice president of operations. Interesting guy because, of course, his background, retired from Senior Intelligence Service from the clandestine Directorate of Operations, U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Hal Putoff, vice president of science and technology for To the Stars. Again, look no further than any weird science program involving government over the last several decades, and you'll probably find Hal Putoff's name. Of course, the press release and, of course, the October press conference announcing the To the Stars Academy also introduced to the world Luis Elizondo as their director of global security and special programs. Again, as early as October 11th, they were saying Elizondo is a career intelligence officer whose experience includes working with the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, the National Counterintelligence Executive, and the Director of National Intelligence. Significantly, they noted he is the former director of programs to investigate unidentified aerial threats for the Office of the Secretary of Defense. They didn't name the program at that time, but they essentially described his role with ATIP. And last but not least, Chris Mellon, National Security Affairs Advisor. Now, there, of course, are others who are involved and others who would be added thereafter, but that was essentially the main lineup at the time this was all rolled out. And although it caused a bit of a splash, I remember when they were live streaming the big announcement and Tom DeLonge had all the guys there on stage and they were introducing everybody. You know, I was there, I was listening, I saw Alejandro there in the chat that they had on the page, and I got Alejandro here on the program thereafter, and we kind of talked about that. But the big surprise was yet to come, because it was in December of that year that the big article appeared online, and of course in no less a paper of significance than the New York Times, Glowing Auras and Black Money, the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program. The significance of the article co-authored by Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal and Helene Cooper in terms of the current UFO debate cannot be emphasized greatly enough. That really is essentially where things began, as far as the current UFO dialogue, because as interesting as it was that Tom DeLonge had founded a new you know, aerospace science and media company. As interesting as all this stuff was, it's when we see a New York Times article saying the Pentagon had a secret program that looked at aerial threats. This is something people should be taking seriously, because apparently our government does. And here are some pilots and people who say they've had experiences with it. There was a whole lot more in that article, but again, there's been so much said about that. No point in revisiting it. But now again, it would be good at this point to come back around to the Bad Robot series on Showtime produced by J.J. Abrams, UFO, because naturally this is a main focus of that program. Naturally, they are looking, and they are looking a lot, at To the Stars Academy, Robert Bigelow, Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, Hal Puthoff, and all these guys. Again, I want to also stay in the spoiler-free zone. That makes it really difficult. Naturally, I want to give you guys a blow-by-blow of everything. You'll have to go and watch it. I know I'll catch hell if I give away too many details from all you guys out there who haven't watched it. And so to try and provide commentary in a way that doesn't take away from what some of you haven't seen yet, but which also weighs in on the significance, the potential significance at least, of what's being discussed in this program. Because again, at times, I'll just tell you this, the show really does take a rather skeptical look at not only To the Stars and people who had been associated with it, but really more broadly at the whole idea of UFOs as being a reality, at least as being a reality apart from a narrative that the government at various intervals throughout history has sought to control and has intentionally steered for reasons that remain unclear to the general public, but there are those who claim that they know what's going on, why it happens, and really what it all means. Now, I mentioned one of the individuals who appears on camera in the series, and that is James Carrion. He was a former international director for MUFON. And at the time that he was director, this, of course, was the period during the history of the Mutual UFO Network when arguably they had struck it rich because they were now getting funding. That's right, there was a fair amount of funding coming into the organization to facilitate research. That funding, of course, was coming from Robert Bigelow. I remember back as far as maybe 2013 or 2014 taking serious interest in that. You know, their national communications director, Roger Marsh, and I had been on the telephone, and I said, can you tell me more about why Bob Bigelow is funding MUFON? What's going on with that? Many people in MUFON leadership in various positions there in MUFON had spoken very candidly to me about, yeah, you know, Bob is providing funding. Here's what's going on. Little did I know, though, that all the questions I had about that at the time and all the inquiries I'd been making were being mirrored by MUFON leadership. James Carrion, of course, had also wanted to know, yeah, the money's coming from Bigelow, but Bigelow says he's got somebody who's sponsoring him. Who is providing the money? He wouldn't say. Carrion asks him, is it coming from government? Bigelow said no. This essentially culminated in Carrion walking away from the organization. And I'll now quote from Carrion's resignation letter, which of course is still available online. I am resigning effective immediately from the MUFON Board of Directors and my position as MUFON International Director. It is obvious to me the board's desire to maintain the Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies relationship has completely sidetracked MUFON from its true allegiances and mission. I am infuriated that BAS has been promised transparency in a response letter that was purposely not copied to me and that I had to receive from a third party because anyone reading it would infer, as I did, that I am being blamed for why the MUFON-BAS relationship is in jeopardy. How dare you state that we are sorry that we gave James responsibility without proper oversight? How dare you bow to BAS's demands for a financial audit when they have no right to do so? All of the issues that they had with bookkeeping in their critique letter, which the board was shocked about, were ridiculous and petty, and to agree with BAS that monies were mishandled without first consulting with me is inexcusable. He goes on to say later in the letter, I have overseen MUFON through one of the greatest recessions since the Great Depression, and the fact that we are still in the black is testament enough to how I have managed MUFON responsibly, even paying for half of the MUFON San Jose Symposium out of my own pocket, and for which I have still not been repaid the amount of $12,000. I have sacrificed so much of my time with my family to serve this organization that does not deserve me or my time any longer. He also states, when MUFON first entered this relationship with Bass, Mr. Bigelow repeatedly stated that they did not want this relationship to be construed as managing MUFON, but that is exactly what it has become. I am appalled at how the board has lost sight of who MUFON answers to as a non-profit organization. It is not Bass. It is not even its members. It is the public that MUFON owes its existence. Anyway, Carrion went on to raise a few more choice issues, and at various times over the years on his personal blog, he had also commented on the issues that he had with where the money that was funding MUFON was actually coming from. And then, after 2017, when we learn about ATIP, when we learn about Harry Reid and others appropriating funding for this program, how Bob Bigelow was able to use this money to fund investigative efforts, with certain information being sent back to government, oh, then it all starts to make sense, doesn't it? That's right. So it was government funding. And again, in the new Showtime series, Carrion makes appearances on camera, and he's also saying, look, in my opinion, throughout time, if we look at history, if we look at the history of the UFO subject, there is one thing that is consistent, and that is the fact that the government has remained involved and that they are always steering the narrative. In his opinion, the only reason really that the government would be involved in funding and thereby essentially trying to control certain aspects of the operations of a civilian UFO group is so that they can control that narrative. And after leaving MUFON, Carrion has really become more and more skeptical. On the Showtime series, he says, you know, people in this community kind of see me as a turncoat. They think I was once a guy who was heavily invested in trying to solve the UFO mystery, and now I'm always constantly trying to tear it down. It might be fair to say that his experience working with the UFO community kind of pushed him in the other direction. And all of his observations about the deception or the deception potential stemming from government, you know, they shouldn't fall on deaf ears. He actually makes some very good points. I find Carrion to be a really interesting guy. But I will quote from a paper that he published a number of years ago called The Greatest Cold War Secret Never Told, UFO's Creation of a Myth, where he notes, unidentified flying objects are a mainstream of American culture. This research paper presents evidence that flying saucers were a myth created out of Cold War intrigue and perpetuated to this day for intelligence and national security reasons. Carrion goes on to say that the deception masters that spun their fine web during World War II honed their craft in the post-war era to confront the new threat of communism, and this is one of their crowning achievements. Cold War historians and investigative journalists who seek virgin territory for research should explore this thread of Cold War history. Now, where I would differ with him is that to say that the entire UFO mystery, the sum total of it all, can be chalked up to being a creation, a myth that was intentionally created, a lie perpetrated by the U.S. government to mislead not so much the American people, but enemy nations. We touched on this earlier. The idea, and again, I think effectively we can call this a conspiracy theory. I don't mean that in the pejorative. I mean that in the purely operative sense of the term, the conspiracy theory that we are presenting here is that UFOs were concocted by government to mislead enemies of the United States into thinking we had more advanced capabilities that we weren't talking about. And Carrion is by no means the only person who has proposed that theory, and in fact, I think that there is some merit to that idea. But where I would differ with Carrion a bit is that rather than saying that's what UFOs are entirely, I would say UFOs appear to represent an actual phenomenon, and a mysterious one, and the U.S. government agencies who have perpetrated lies about them saw an opportunity. I don't think that they necessarily created UFOs per se. I think that what we saw was an opportunistic effort by intelligence agencies to co-opt the narrative when and where they could, based upon their own realization of an apparent reality, or at least enough people believing in the apparent reality of UFOs. But then again, I'm not so sure that I do differ with Carrion all that much, because I've even heard him say on camera in the Showtime series, it's very possible that we've been visited. You know, life from other worlds may have come to Earth. He seems to be open to those possibilities. I just don't think he puts as much stock in the reality of there being a UFO phenomenon any more than I necessarily equate that UFO phenomenon with the idea of extraterrestrial visitors. That's one possibility. I wouldn't rule it out. And I certainly wouldn't put any more emphasis or faith behind other ideas like that the government created UFOs. But then again, everyone's got their theories and they're entitled to them. We'll wrap things up when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. UFOs, truth, lies, and conspiracies. It's hard to know what is fact and what is fiction sometimes in this field. It's hard to be able to look at it in truth with a truly unbiased perspective. You know, again, calling back to the last segment, if we conclude that all UFOs are the result of a myth perpetuated by the government, I mean, really, that leaves you no other interpretation, if that's what you believe, of the involvement of guys like Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, and others. And I realize a lot of people think that the only conclusion is, well, UFOs, first of all, if there are actual tangible craft, those are built by us, and with or without those, the belief in UFOs is something that the government has essentially helped to foster over time. Now, we actually might say that's true. I mean, you can't deny the fact that what framed the narrative that we have, of course, been discussing in recent years, the so-called shot heard round the world, what was reported by the New York Times in 2017, and what has remained on everybody's mind since then, of course, has been the reality of the Pentagon's apparent interest in this. Oh, well, if the Pentagon's interested in these kinds of aerial threats, then it must be significant. And of course, here again, I've got to take issue. I've got to play the contrarian. Not only do I think that there is probably enough data supporting the idea of a reality to UFOs outside of psyops, misdirection, misinformation, disinformation presented by government, I also think that it is a problem when the only aspects that people assign significance to when it comes to UFOs are those having to do with the government and its association with the subject. I think it is a huge problem when we assign disproportionate significance to government involvement and, of course, the leaked information coming out of government about this subject. Hell, that right there is really what I would call the definition of a red flag. When information is leaked from government, yeah, that's what everybody wants to see. But again, where better could one expect there to be sure signs of disinformation than data leaked out of government? Why do you think it was leaked? How do you think it makes its way out of government into the civilian sphere? Again, not to say that Navy videos or other data that is occasionally leaked out of government related to UFOs, it's not to say that that is all disinformation, but I am saying that when it is leaked out of government, the fact that it makes its way into the public sphere through unauthorized means to me is inherently a red flag. And that is all the more reason I continue to hammer on the fact that scientists in the civilian academic community need to be looking at this. This is why we've had Chris Impey on the program. This is why we've had Avi Loeb on the program. This is why in the weeks ahead, joining past appearances by members of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, we'll have other members, we'll have other astronomers, astrobiologists, and other scientific commentators, because if we ever really want to be able to understand if there is a reality to this phenomena, we are going to have to stop relying exclusively on government data. There is simply no other way. And let me tell you why that's true. Let me make the case for you. If there's a reality, and the government is collecting data on these things, as they appear to be doing, we cannot expect that they are going to be able to release all that they have. Essentially, as long as we continue to rely on government for the acquisition of UFO data, we are going to have to remain content with simply getting acknowledgement. Right? What we saw in that preliminary assessment, 144 instances of UAP that we couldn't explain. What are the details? Where are the photographs? Where's the instrumental data? Where are the interviews with the servicemen and women who actually experienced these things? Zip, nada, zilch. You don't see anything beyond, well, we have things that we have been observing, people see, that we think represent tangible objects. We don't know what they are. But yeah, we've got some data. As long as we rely on government, if we presume that there is an actual phenomena and that they aren't just lying to us, that's essentially all we're going to get, at least for the time being and for the next few years. And on the outside chance that James Carrion and others are correct, and that indeed there is a disinformation campaign going on, here again it is incumbent upon scientists to independently gather data outside of what the government provides, because only then will we get independent, non-governmental confirmation of any possible reality behind the UFO issue. So in my opinion, in conclusion, we need scientists, not government scientists, we need civilian scientists looking at the UFO issue. And simply put, even if the UFO phenomena is valid and real, it's going to be hard for us to be able to determine conclusively if that is the case, for as long as we continue to rely on government as much as we do. And again, whether you are one of those conspiracy theorists who think that there is something wrong about the current UFO narrative, you think it's more than a little fishy that every few years when people stop paying attention to UFOs, like they had apparently done in the early 2000s, and then something happens to stir up all that interest again, if you find that suspicious, or if you have high hopes for the UAP task force and you're hoping that those 144 instances that they give us no details about, but which they say they can't identify, actually do represent a phenomena. Whatever the case, that's all the more reason to me that we need scientists involved. We need civilian reporters involved, like the debrief team and I have endeavored to do since December with the launch of that publication. We're interested in what government says, we're interested in what scientists have to say, and we are working, striving in fact, to provide an unfiltered civilian perspective on the UFO issue. But if we want answers, again, we're going to need those scientists involved. We're going to need them looking at this issue. And in my humble opinion as your friendly neighborhood podcaster, ladies and gents, we've got to overcome our biases and our stigmas about the only important information being the stuff that government gives us. At the end of the day, and in the long run, that may end up being far less useful to us than data that we, you and I, and the neighborhood scientists at our fine universities can collect ourselves. So let's get to work. All right, guys, that'll be the final word on this week's edition of the program. Thanks, as always, for being here and being a part of it. And of course, this show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.